Yeah, I wouldn't say it sounded like the biggest hit of their career, which it certainly became, and to this day, it still is. If you look at, like, their Spotify numbers and all that kind of stuff, "Losing My Religion" is the song. It's the song they wanted to play at the Songwriter Hall of Fame. They were going to play something. What's the obvious song to play, especially since they wanted to play acoustically? "Losing My Religion," because it works that way. It would work a cappella. It would work as a cover, which is why so many people have done it. But I'd say the first time I heard the song, it was a bit of a grower. It was a beautiful song. It had that haunting riff, the mandolin riff, and the, but it wasn't an obvious slam dunk. Oh my God, this is going to be the biggest song in their career, kind of a sense at all. And I've told the story before. I'll give as much detail as you want on this, but it was very close to not being the first single on that record. And we all knew that the big hit on the record was a song called "Shiny Happy People," which is a fine song. It's a pop song. It's a bit of a goofy song, just from the title on and the video. "Shiny Happy People" was kind of set up to be the big song. So nobody wanted it to come out first. So the question became, what should be the kind of setup song? What should be the song that comes out to let people know there's a new record by R.E.M.? It had been 3 years. It was the longest break they'd taken between releasing records since Green to Out of Time was almost 3 years. And so the discussion was, should it be a couple of different songs? And it was really kind of a last minute decision by the main people at Warner Brothers Records, our new record company, that decided to go with what they kind of knew the band felt most strongly about. They felt like it was the best song on the record. It was a really good insight into the kind of songwriting they were doing, and had this unusual instrumentation without hardly any guitar, mostly mandolin. Certainly not a rocker, not in the, jingle jangle mode of a lot of their signature stuff. And it just became kind of this out of the blue hit. It built very slowly, but over time, month after month, all through the summer of 91, it became a hit everywhere. And like I say, to this day, all these years later, it's the song people are most interested in and want to hear over and over again.
You mentioned Warner Brothers, and that move, in retrospect, it looks like such a smart move, but there were a lot of reasons behind it. They were really perceived in those days as an artist's record
Oh, yeah.
company. They supported people like a friend of our show, Van Dyke Parks, and Randy Newman, despite a lack of big commercial success. But when you got guys like Lenny Warnker and Mo Austin in charge, you get a very music-centric label, and that wasn't the case for everybody.
That is correct. And that was not just a lot of why the band moved to Warner Brothers. It was the reason the band moved to Warner Brothers. It was not. Every label talked about being artist-centric. Every label talked about complete creative control to the artist. Every label talked about being a priority and how much they love the band and we're going to help. And I'm sure all the labels meant it. But the ones that had the records to prove it, the record collection, it was uncanny how many of the, you mentioned a bunch of them, but to that I would add maybe, oh, it was Bonnie Raitt on Warner Brothers at the
Yes,
time.
she was.
And they had a Captain Beefheart maybe. I remember when the decision was being made, so many like what people would consider very off Broadway, that's not the right term, but out of the blue, unlikely major label artists were on that label. And that said to the band, these guys really mean it. They really, that's just how they run their business. And Lenny being a record producer, that certainly didn't hurt. I mean, they talked the same language. He used the same vocabulary. He got them as artists and could talk, chord changes and tempo. And he was just a, he was a, he never produced a record by R.E.M., but he was certainly around and interested, as was Mo Austin, who was more the business guy and the kind of they were a great tag team while it lasted. It was really only the first 5 or 6 years we were on Warner Brothers that they were there, and then there was a big corporate shakeup, and they were not there after about 93, 94, which was a shame, obviously. But we've stayed close with those guys until Mo died fairly recently, and certainly Lenny is still going pretty strong. And they were the key. And what you just identified, you've obviously, you know what you're talking about. That was entirely the reason they made that move to go from IRS after the first five records, ready for a major label, a global label, somewhere that is coordinated around the world at the same time. And Warner Brothers was kind of the obvious choice for them for those reasons.
But, and also a company that would listen as the band said, oh, and by the way, we've got this huge album. We're not going to tour.
Yeah, I won't say that was the most popular decision that they ever made. But, you know, it was self-preservation for the band. They'd been touring all through the 80s. They had toured the entire year of 1989 around the album Green. There had been significant health scares that year, not nearly as bad as what was looming in 95, which, of course, we didn't know about. So, yeah, they took two records off. It was never any kind of a master plan, like to try to repeat it at home, where you say, all right, let's just bump, keep going, have all your records come out, and then don't tour two of your records, and they'll become the two biggest records of your career. It's weird to look back on, but that is the way it played out. Now, the secret of all that was that while we didn't tour for the 91 record Out of Time or the 92 record Automatic for the People, we did a lot of promotional stuff. We did Mountain Stage down in West Virginia. Mm. We did Saturday Night Live in New York City. We did some stuff for the BBC, for the main German and Scandinavian networks. And
MTV.
Italy. What's that?
MTV, of course.
Oh, MTV, absolutely. So there were other ways to get the word out. I mean, the world was now a lot different than it had been in the early 80s, when the only way you got the word out was to go out and tour. Now there are ways, not wearing yourself out on tour, giving your all four or five nights a week, several times in a row, you know, moving from city to city. There were ways to do these kind of strategic, do it for a couple of weeks, make it count, reach a lot of people that way. And then, yeah, MTV and the video being loved and played over and over again. And then some of the shows on MTV and some of the award shows, all that had an effect to be able to add up to a lot of critical mass for them becoming a really popular band at the time. And, you know, partly it was the good music, partly it was some luck thrown in there. But, yeah, we didn't really expect all that in years we weren't touring. And then by the time we toured again in 95, the band was excited about it. They were certainly not just going through the motions. They were psyched to be back out on the road doing all these shows. And there was a lot of demand there. They had their two biggest records, not to mention all the IRS stuff. And they could choose a pretty good set list every night and a pretty different set list every night as they rolled through the world the whole year of 95.
Well, and as you alluded to, that monster tour fraught with some issues, the health problems of first Bill with the aneurysm and then surgeries for Mike and Michael. But at the same time, was it in many ways the apex of their commercial success and their popularity. And what a wonderful tour it turned out to be despite those problems.
Yeah. Wonderful is, it's hard to, for me and some of the memories of what you just ran through 30 years ago, it was wonderful in parts and it was fraught and it made you realize the fragility of all of it. Yeah, it was kind of the year that was for the band. Surgeries in March, July, and August. Thankfully, not all as serious as Bill's. Bill's was the most serious, the brain aneurysm in Switzerland. One thing we learned: if you're going to have a brain aneurysm surgery, have it in Switzerland. It was the best place we could possibly have been for that to happen, and him to be operated on by two very skilled physicians. That was it was a scary time, to say the least. But we got through all that, all the way through the fall. And then the 95 tour, when it was over, it was like, all right, we're not touring next year either. So we didn't tour for New Adventures. New Adventures had been made a lot on the road. They'd written a lot. They wanted to use their sound checks productively. They were always a prolific band. They always loved coming up with new stuff. And rather than just go tour and just play the same stuff over, they were writing new songs while they were touring. And they ended up using a lot of that on the album New Adventures in Hi-Fi.
I think I read or saw an interview where you said that you ended up borrowing a lot of ideas of how to make a tour run successfully from the way you two did things.
Absolutely. One night in particular, I remember going to a show. It was on Bastille Day, and it must have been 92 or 93. It would easily be looked up. I feel like it was 93, but my wife and I went to see U2 play at Marseille. So that was pretty wild to be in the south of France where the U2 guys are playing on July 14th. And I came back from the show and got a legal pad out and just jotted down notes of like just the whole shebang, the whole way they did it. And it was I mean, from a management standpoint, just the way that it operated, the some of the aspects of the way they presented themselves and the way they treated their guests and the way they treated their fans. And I would love to go back, and someday, I don't ever throw anything away, so someday I will uncover that list. But it was like a one sheet, 10 bullet points just scribbled out. I shamelessly cop to that. U2 and there were we were lucky enough to see them a bunch of times, and I was certainly taking notes literally.
We're talking with Burtis Downs. I wanted to ask you, when you became the band's manager after advising and working with them for many years, was it more about managing logistics or managing people?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, I felt like my job was helping them realize their what they wanted to be as artists and have that translate into the world of business. And so sometimes that involves logistics. It certainly involves a lot of liaison work with record companies and agents and business managers and insurance companies and all the various aspects of their business. I was able to kind of represent them and their interests to help put their vision into action. And logistics, I kind of think of that as like hiring the trucks and the buses and the crew and the production manager and the rigger, and all those things are important. But thankfully, there are really good people out there to do those things. So I would be involved in kind of setting that team up and putting all that in motion, and then presumably and hopefully and most of the time it all goes well, and you carry on until you have to everything comes to a screeching halt when something like a major surgery happens and you have to cancel whole swaths of a tour that was all sold out and obviously has some major business implications. So a little bit of both, but a lot of it was just when you're dealing with artists, a group is different than an individual. When it's an individual, I learned a lot from John Landau too, in terms of like some of the stuff we did with them and some of the benefits stuff we did, Vote for Change in particular. But he's dealing with one guy. It's really just John and Bruce. And that's a very different job than dealing with four guys, four equal partners. And some of them are more interested in some parts of it, but a whole lot of it was, the dreaded band meeting, getting everybody to talk, getting everybody to just, put it out there on the table and I'll talk it through and come up with a consensus. They had a rule all through their career to work by consensus. They all had veto rights, but they very sparingly, I don't really recall, things usually progressed to the point where there didn't need to be a vote. There didn't need to be a veto. And they just decided they're going to work until they all agree on something. They're going to keep hashing it out till they do.
You mentioning John Landau reminded me of a story back in the mid-80s. I was doing country radio and decided to play a couple songs from Born in the USA on our country station. I'm on Fire and My Hometown, and I think either Billboard or Radio and Records did a little article about it. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, I got a package in the mail and a letter from John Landau thanking me for exposing Bruce to this new audience, and copies of every vinyl they had released since the beginning, and then an acetate, a test pressing of the new single, which was amazing. And I also played Don't Go Back to Rockville on our country station back in the
Well,
day.
I always wondered why that wasn't a hit.
I
I
thought it
always
should have
thought
been.
some country artist ought to cover that song. Somebody with a big name, who's a country artist, they don't always write all their own songs. They're more than happy to do covers if it's a catchy song. I've always wondered why that song never really kind of caught on at country radio. It seems to me like it would,
Yeah,
but
I would think so. But
we
we
never
played it.
worked it.
We were
Yeah,
at.
that's good to know. That's good to know.
When Bill made his decision to walk away, were you taken by surprise or were the signs there?
It's hard to remember. At the time, I was certainly taken by surprise. I guess looking back on it, It was fairly soon and probably in some way related to the surgery it just had. I've never been through that. Most of us haven't ever been through that. I think it's a fairly common thing when major brain surgery like that really does have you reassess where you are and where you want to be and if it's making sense.